Chapter 16. The morning came. The sky, which had been remarkably clear down to within a day or two, was overcast, and the weather threatening, the wind having an unmistakable hint of water in it. Henchard wished he had not been quite so sure about the continuance of a fair season. But it was too late to modify or postpone, and the proceedings went on. At 12 o'clock the rain began to fall, small and steady, commencing and increasing so insensibly that it was difficult to state exactly when dry weather ended, or wet established itself. In an hour the slight moisture resolved itself into a monotonous smiting of earth by heaven, in torrents to which no end could be prognosticated. A number of people had heroically gathered in the field, but by 3 o'clock Henchard discerned that his project was doomed to end in failure. The hams at the top of the poles dripped watered smoke in the form of a brown liquor, the pig shivered in the wind, the grain of the deal tables showed through the sticking tablecloths, for the awning allowed the rain to drift under at its will, and to enclose the sides at this hour seemed a useless undertaking. The landscape over the river disappeared. The wind played on the tent cords in aeolian improvisations, and at length rose to such a pitch that the whole erection slanted to the ground, those who had taken shelter within it having to crawl out on their hands and knees. But toward 6 the storm abated, and a drier breeze shook the moisture from the grass bents. It seemed possible to carry out the program after all. The awning was set up again. The band was called out from its shelter, and ordered to begin, and where the tables had stood a place was cleared for dancing. "But where are the folk?" said Henchard, after the lapse of half an hour, during which time only 2 men and a woman had stood up to dance. "He shops are all shut. Why don't they come?" "They are at Farfrey's affair in the West Walk," answered a councilman who stood in the field with the mayor. "A few, I suppose. But where are the body o'em? All out of doors are there. Then the more fools they." Henchard walked away moodily. 1 or 2 young fellows gallantly came to climb the poles, to save the hams from being wasted. But as there were no spectators, and the whole scene presented the most melancholy appearance, Henchard gave orders that the proceedings were to be suspended, and the entertainment closed, the food to be distributed among the poor people of the town. In a short time nothing was left in the field but a few hurdles, the tents, and the poles. Henchard returned to his house, had tea with his wife and daughter, and then walked out. It was now dusk. He soon saw that the tendency of all promenaders was towards a particular spot in the walks, and eventually proceeded thither himself. The notes of a string band came from the enclosure that Farfrey had erected, the pavilion as he called it, and when the mayor reached it, he perceived that a gigantic tent had been ingeniously constructed without poles or ropes. The densest point of the avenue of sycamores had been selected, where the boughs made a closely interlaced vault overhead. To these boughs the canvas had been hung, and a barrel roof was the result. The end towards the wind was enclosed, the other end was open. Henchard went round and saw the interior. In form it was like the nave of a cathedral with one gable removed, but the scene within was anything but devotional. A reel or fling of some sort was in progress, and the usually sedate Farfrey was in the midst of the other dancers in the costume of a wild Highlander, flinging himself about and spinning to the tune. For a moment Henchard could not help laughing. Then he perceived the immense admiration for the Scotchman that revealed itself in the women's faces. And when this exhibition was over, and a new dance proposed, and Donald had disappeared for a time, to return in his natural garments, he had an unlimited choice of partners, every girl being in a coming-on disposition towards one who so thoroughly understood the poetry of motion as he. All the town crowded to the walk, such a delightful idea of a ballroom never having occurred to the inhabitants before. Among the rest of the onlookers were Elizabeth and her mother, the former thoughtful yet much interested, her eyes beaming with a longing, lingering light, as if nature had been advised by Correggio in their creation. The dancing progressed with unabated spirit, and Henchard walked and waited till his wife should be disposed to go home. He did not care to keep in the light, and when he went into the dark it was worse, for there he heard remarks of a kind which were becoming too frequent. Mr. Henchard's rejoicings couldn't say good morning to this, said one. Man must be a headstrong stumble to think folk would go up to that bleak place today. The other answered that people said it was not only in such things as those that the mayor was wanting. Here would his business be if it were not for this young fellow? 'Twas verily fortune sent him to Henchard. His accounts were like a bramble wood when Mr. Farfrey came. He used to reckon his sacks by chalk strokes all in a row like garden palings, measure his ricks by stretching with his arms, weigh his trusses by a lift, judge his hay by a chaw, and settle the price with a curse. But now this accomplished young man does it all by ciphering and mensuration. Then the wheat, that sometimes used to taste so strong o' mice when made into bread, that people could fairly tell the breed Farfrey as a plan for purifying, so that nobody would dream the smallest four-legged beast had walked over it once. Oh yes, everybody is full of him, and the care Mr. Henchard has to keep him, to be sure, concluded this gentleman. But he won't do it for long, good now, said the other. No, said Henchard to himself behind the tree. Or if he do, he'll be honeycombed clean out of all the character and standing that he's built up in these 18 year. He went back to the dancing pavilion. Farfrey was footing a quaint little dance with Elizabeth Jane, an old country thing, the only one she knew, and though he considerately toned down his movements, to suit her demure gait, the pattern of the shining little nails in the soles of his boots became familiar to the eyes of every bystander. The tune had enticed her into it, being a tune of a busy, vaulting, leaping sort, some low notes on the silver string of each fiddle, then a skipping on the small, like running up and down ladders. Ismliad of Air was its name, so Mr. Farfrey had said, and that it was very popular in his own country. It was soon over, and the girl looked at Henchard for approval, but he did not give it. He seemed not to see her. Look here, Farfrey, he said, like one whose mind was elsewhere, I'll go to Port Bredy Great Market tomorrow myself. You can stay, and put things right in your clothes box, and recover strength to your knees after your vagaries. He planted on Donald an antagonistic glare that had begun as a smile. Some other townsmen came up, and Donald drew aside. Hats this, Henchard, said Alderman Tubber, applying his thumb to the corn factor like a cheese taster. An opposition randy to yours, eh? Jack's as good as his master, eh? Cut he out quite, hasn't he? You see, Mr. Henchard, said the lawyer, another good-natured friend, where you made the mistake was in going so far afield. You should have taken a leaf out of his book, and have had your sports in a sheltered place like this. But you didn't think of it, you see, and he did, and that's where he's beat you. He'll be top sawyer soon of you too, and carry all afore him, added jocular Mr. Tubber. No, said Henchard gloomily. He won't be that, because he's shortly going to leave me. He looked towards Donald, who had come near. Mr. Farfrey's time as my manager is drawing to a close, isn't it, Farfrey? The young man, who could now read the lines and folds of Henchard's strongly traced face, as if they were clear verbal inscriptions, quietly assented. And when people deplored the fact and asked why it was, he simply replied that Mr. Henchard no longer required his help. Henchard went home, apparently satisfied. But in the morning, when his jealous temper had passed away, his heart sank within him at what he had said and done. He was the more disturbed when he found that this time Farfrey was determined to take him at his word. 17. Elizabeth Jane had perceived from Henchard's manner that in assenting to dances he had made a mistake of some kind. In her simplicity she did not know what it was till a hint from a nodding acquaintance enlightened her. As the mayor's stepdaughter, she learned, as he had not been quite in her place in treading a measure amid such a mixed throng as filled the dancing pavilion. Thereupon her ears, cheeks, and chin glowed like live coals at the dawning of the idea that her tastes were not good enough for her position, and would bring her into disgrace. This made her very miserable, and she looked about for her mother, but Mrs. Henchard, who had less idea of conventionality than Elizabeth herself, had gone away, leaving her daughter to return at her own pleasure. The latter moved on into the dark, dense old avenues, or rather vaults of living woodwork, which ran along the town boundary, and stood reflecting. A man followed in a few minutes, and her face being towards the shine from the tent, he recognized her. It was Farfrae, just come from the dialogue with Henchard which had signified his dismissal. "And it's you, Miss Newson? And I've been looking for ye everywhere," he said, overcoming a sadness imparted by the estrangement with the corn merchant. "Ay, I walk on with you as far as your street corner?" She thought there might be something wrong in this, but did not utter any objection. So together they went on, first down the west walk, and then into the bowling walk, till Farfrae said, "It's like that I'm going to leave you soon." She faltered, "Why?" "Oh, as a mere matter of business, nothing more. But we'll not concern ourselves about it, it is for the best. I hope to have another dance with you." She said she could not dance in any proper way. "Nay, but you do. It's the feeling for it, rather than the learning of steps, that makes pleasant dancers. I fear I offended your father by getting up this. And now, perhaps, I'll have to go to another part of the world altogether." This seemed such a melancholy prospect that Elizabeth Jane breathed a sigh, letting it off in fragments, that he might not hear her. But darkness makes people truthful, and the Scotchman went on impulsively, perhaps he had heard her after all. "I wish I was richer, Miss Newson, and your stepfather had not been offended. I would ask you something in a short time, yes, I would ask you tonight. But that's not for me." What he would have asked her, he did not say, and instead of encouraging him, she remained incompetently silent. Thus afraid one of another, they continued their promenade along the walls till they got near the bottom of the bowling walk. 20 steps further and the trees would end, and the street corner and lamps appear. In consciousness of this, they stopped. "I never found out who it was that sent us to Durnover Granary on a fool's errand that day," said Donald, in his undulating tones. "Did ye ever know yourself, Miss Newson?" "Never," said she. "I wonder why they did it. For fun, perhaps." "Perhaps it was not for fun. It might have been that they thought they would like us to stay waiting there, talking to one another. Eh, well. I hope you Casterbridge folk will not forget me if I go." "That I'm sure we won't," she said earnestly. "Wish you wouldn't go at all." They had got into the lamplight. "Ow, I'll think over that," said Donald Farfrae. "And I'll not come up to your door, but part from you here, lest it make your father more angry still." They parted, Farfrae returning into the dark bowling walk, and Elizabeth Jane going up the street. Without any consciousness of what she was doing, she started running with all her might till she reached her father's door. "Dear me, what am I at?" she thought, as she pulled up breathless. Indoors she fell to conjecturing the meaning of Farfrae's enigmatic words about not daring to ask her what he fain would. Elizabeth, that silent observing woman, had long noted how he was rising in favor among the townspeople, and knowing Henchard's nature now, as he had feared that Farfrae's days as manager were numbered, so that the announcement gave her little surprise. Would Mr. Farfrae stay in Casterbridge despite his words and her father's dismissal? His occult breathings to her might be solvable by his course in that respect. The next day was windy, so windy that walking in the garden she picked up a portion of the draft of a letter on business in Donald Farfrae's writing, which had flown over the wall from the office. The useless scrap she took indoors, and began to copy the calligraphy, which she much admired. The letter began, "Dear Sir," and presently writing on a loose slip, "Elizabeth Jane," she laid the latter over her, making the phrase "Dear Elizabeth Jane." When she saw the effect, a quick red ran up her face, and warmed her through. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.